Okay, and welcome back to this interview portion of Shockwaves. We're really excited. I mean, we've done so many episodes at this point and had so many different guests on from all different aspects of the film industry, of the horror genre. But I can safely say that I don't know a man that has shaped us more in our formative young years than the creator of The Toxic Avenger.
And yeah. First filmmaking book I ever read.
First filmmaking book.
We have talked about having him on so much, and we finally get the opportunity.
He's a legend. Here he is, Lloyd Kaufman. Welcome.
Wow, thank you so much. Thank you, Shockwaves. I'm in shock that you said something nice. That's amazing.
And you know, we had Oz Perkins on the show, the son of Anthony Perkins,
of
who's now a filmmaker, writing, and directing.
Sure.
And when we asked him about his earliest horror recollections, he said when he was 12, he'd have 20 kids sleep over, and they'd be forced to watch The Toxic Avenger, which we thought you'd get a kick out of.
Well, you know, David Bryan, who wrote the music for The Toxic Avenger musical, which is, I think it played out here.
It's
he was 12 when he saw The Toxic Avenger and vowed that he would write a musical about it.
And he
that's
wrote
some follow through.
And I'm not bullshitting you. He wrote that in the program in London. I mean, it was right there with his signature. So
that's
it's real.
Ever expect to see The Toxic Avenger playing on stage in London? Was that like something that you'd planned from the get-go?
Well,
he thought it would be a Star Trek
Bookie like,
Man.
I sort of thought Terrence Malick was going to.
Yeah. Hey, it could still happen. He's more active now. You know?
Yeah.
Now, here's the thing. Obviously, between trauma and you know, just your film history. I've actually interviewed you in the past before, and you're always such a knowledgeable. Film historian. I mean, you love all sorts of films. You have a history with John Avildsen, which is fascinating. But here's the thing. I know nothing about young Lloyd, about little Lloyd, Lloyd who fell in love with movies. I was wondering if you'd talk a little bit about
Lloyd
that.
Before I met Bryan Singer? That
yes,
Lloyd?
That yeah. Lloyd.
Yeah. Yeah, we always start with the Lloyd in college, but we want to go back and find out like what really influenced you as a kid.
Yeah, I mean, did you always, when you were a young man, just first watching films, did you fall in love with them right away? Was this kind of the trajectory you thought?
No way. In fact, my parents educated me very traditionally. All boys school, Yale, all boys, the whole high school, grade school. Musicals, theater. My mother was a theater person. And movies, she sort of looked down on movies. I didn't go to too many movies. And Oliver Stone, who was I met in second grade, he and his mother were big movie fans. So I think I saw more movies with them. My folks were not big moviegoers.
You hung out with Oliver Stone in elementary school.
Yeah, he and I were very tight. Our parents were best friends. In fact, he got into movies because of me. When we were at Yale, I was making movies. He was writing a shitty novel. A really shitty novel, and he started hanging out with us making the movies. And turns out he's a genius on the movie side. When the first book that you read, Elric, All I Need to Know About Filmmaking, I Learned from The Toxic Avenger. Yeah. That first book, which I wrote, which was written by James Gunn, that book was in the back of. I was doing signings at Book Soup. And, of course, if you needed my book, you had to go in the back of the store or whatever. Oliver's crappy novel that he wrote in college, sitting there in the window of the, you know, of the bookstore. So.
Whatever. We all own your book.
No. Yeah. Well, none of us read Oliver
Stone books. Get out of here.
Well, he's a legend. Yeah. He's in Battle of Love's Return, my first movie, and he helped. He was one of the producers on Sugar Cookies with Mary Warrenov and Monique Van Voren.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, was there something that really just blew you away that you...
I have to blame it on Yale University. I really had no intention of making movies. I was going to be a school teacher or a social worker and teach people with hooks for hands how to finger paint or teach bums bums how to paint happy faces on beads and string the beads together and all that kind of stuff.
It's not too late.
Well, no, I've got an opening at Walmart.
Okay.
Hello, welcome to Walmart. Can I help you? So freshman year, I got put in a room with a movie nut who ran the Yale Film Society. A very small room. Our beds were head to toe, and at night I'd inhale his Godard stinking feet, and the aroma du trauma was starting to percolate, and I just kept drifting into the Yale Film Society and kept getting blown away by Chaplin, Keaton, Stan Brakhage, the greatest visual artist of my lifetime, except, of course, for Shock, for your podcast, of course. Shockwaves.
Yeah.
And finally, one night I was watching, I think I was trolling for gay Yale boys, and there were about six people in the theater, but they put on Ernst Lubitsch's To Be or Not to Be.
Oh my gosh, it's hilarious.
And it's better than the Mel Brooks movie.
I think so.
And Mel
as well.
Brooks is a Lubitsch genius. Tub. I mean, Mel Brooks, his anthem is, our Troma Entertainment's anthem is producers, obviously. And I am wearing a cardboard belt. But the To Be or Not to Be by Lubitsch is far and away a masterpiece. It's so crazy and so brilliant and so disciplined, and it's yin and yang all the way. And I majored in Chinese studies, and it's a perfect film. During that movie is when I decided I would give what I have to give to the
arts.
People out there in the dark.
I remember a professor showing us Lubitsch's To Be or Not to Be freshman year of college, and it blew me away because I'd never seen anything like it, and it was so funny, but I couldn't believe that it was as old as it was, because at the time, as like an 18-year-old, I was like, no, humor is contemporary. How is this? And it just completely blew my mind.
Yeah, it's a masterpiece.
It's amazing.
Well, every film Lubitsch did he was one of the greats, one of the all-time greats.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So some of the Keaton and Chaplin, there's so much physical comedy that I can see how that strand definitely
Toxic
runs
Avenger
into your
part.
Films.
Toxic Avenger 2 and 3, lots of Keaton. Mm-hmm. Lots of Keaton.
Elric's son is named after Keaton.
Yeah,
I just have to say that.
Like 2.5-year-old Keaton.
Yeah. Well, yeah. That's wonderful. That's
Michael Keaton. And well, I actually figured there was no bad Keaton. So it was Buster, Michael, and Diane.
Yeah, they're all brilliant.
That's they're all okay.
Damn, I wish I was named Keaton.
But like, was there on the horror front or like even just like strange movies? Because those are classics and, art house films. How did, and I know Corman's similar in a sense because, a lot of his influences
was
were
a big
high-end art films that
Corman
he
was a big
in,
deal
yeah.
because at Yale I not only discovered Leni Riefenstahl and Fritz Lang, and again, I majored in Chinese studies. I had no interest in film. There were no film courses. I think there was one film, Stan Lauder taught a film history, an overview, very, I knew everything. I didn't need to go, but it filled up the dance card. And so I just started becoming obsessed with movies because of the Film Society and my roommate. And they had a little office which had stacks of the Cahiers du Cinéma, the notebook, the magazine of the French Cinematheque. And I speak fluent French, so I started reading those things. And they had articles by Chabrol and Godard and those guys who were just starting to transition into being movie makers from being journalists.
Yeah.
And I bought into the auteur theory of filmmaking, in which propounds that the director should be the dictator, really, of the movie, that his soul or her heart or brain or whatever should dominate. But I've never said a film or filmed de Lloyd Kaufman. Uh-huh. I don't think that really is proper. And every idiot now signs his usually white guys, his movie with a film by. I'll never the first time it hit me was a movie about a volcano, Dante's Peak, I think it was called. It was garbage, and it was
Roger
horrible.
Donaldson, I remember he directed
it. And it was a volcano movie with no lava, but it was one of those $200 million movies when nobody was making that kind of budget. Huge movie, and it's a film by so-and-so. I go, James Gunn and I were sitting in the audience, and I was like, what the heck? James also wrote Romeo and Juliet.
Mm-hmm.
And, not sure what happened after that.
He flatlined.
I heard a rumor he's doing all right.
He's doing all right.
What was the first story? I mean, if
did
Corman...
Did he join the Guardian Angels? No.
Yeah. There's something.
Yeah.
What was the first in that same time period of the, say, Corman, or where you realized the film could be made cheaply?
Yeah, Corman.
With an exploitive
value.
The
movies that Corman directed are terrific.
Yeah.
And the Poe... the Poe were like looking at Chabrol. You know, they're just horror.
They're gorgeous.
Yeah, they're beautiful.
So do you ever see the Shatner film he made about race relations, The Intruder, I believe?
Intruder, I have not seen it.
It's like the one which scared him to go back to making exploitation films, but it's such a good movie.
Isn't that great?
It's almost like could have been an Oscar movie, but because they didn't make any money.
Well, The Trip, every time I get to see his films on a big screen, I mean, he's great, great, great. But he proved that you could make good movies for low budget with good acting and provocative scripts. And not that I followed that formula, but and we're very good buddies. They love Pat, my wife, the commissioner. They love her, Roger and Julie and the kiddies. And clearly he's a big influence. I've never had the privilege of working with him. But
is that when it clicked, though, that you could – I'm always curious, like the moment you're talking about the new wave directors being one of the moments where it clicks that you could do that. Was it that or Corman's model that made you go, oh, we could produce a cheapish film, make a profit?
I think Corman proved that it could be done. But I bought into the I took acid one night. My senior year at Yale, I was alone. I took LSD. And I had two job opportunities, one with the Owl and the Pussycat. Here, obviously, in Los Angeles, and another job with a crappy little company called Canon. And under acid, I took the Canon job, and that's where I met John Avildsen, and that kind of led me on that particular path, and stayed in New York, and then met the commissioner here, who loves New York. You know, wouldn't want to live anywhere else. So. That's kind of how it the decision was made. I could have either worked with the whiniest actress in Hollywood, Barbara Streisand, who starred in The Owl and the Pussycat, or Canon. And then I met John Avildsen on the set of Joe, and we're still buddies, and got to work on Rocky and Cry Uncle, and he's a big influence. I think he was sort of, I would say he and John Badham were my film school. I got lucky. I got jobs on two interesting, even though they're mainstream movies. They are filmed by directors who are auteurs and who are smart and who film films from their heart and not from their pocketbooks.
Did you get a sense of it being special, being inside Rocky? Because, I mean, sometimes you're just on a production.
I had a sense of Joe being special. I remember to this day, the first day I went to, I was sent from the Canon office where I was cleaning toilets. They needed somebody, and I was the Yale guy. They needed someone on set, I guess, to clean toilets. And I remember looking at the first shot that he was setting up that day. It was through a furnace. And I remember I went over to the camera to look through the lens. And then they no, you can't do that. You get away from there. You're in the union. And I said, what does that mean? The union? What? Who? What? And, but I remember I'm going to attach myself to Avildsen, which I did. And, when after Joe, I worked for him for free, and then I got promoted to production manager. And actually, we raised some money for Cry Uncle. So Cry Uncle, I learned a lot. Troma's still distributing. It's so wonderful. If you haven't seen Joe or Cry Uncle, those are brilliant films. Joe is Peter Boyle's first movie with Susan Sarandon's first movie. I think I'm in it, and I think I get killed at the end of the movie. I believe I'm one of the hippies.
Your wife's confirming. Yeah. You die that may also, as a hippie.
That may have been a wish, but we've been married 42 years, the poor woman. She was Pat was the film commissioner of the state of New York for 20 years, appointed by both Republican and Democratic governors, which is incredible just to begin with, because film commissioners are political plums. She wrote the incentive, which has brought billions of dollars in jobs to New York State. And the reason I'm not able to stay at the American Film Market is Pat's getting a New York State award. The state's giving her a big award for upstate. Her incentives literally kickstarted part of the New York State. Was when we were there, we had drive-by shootings. We were filming Poultrygeist, Night of the Chicken Dead in Buffalo at a derelict McDonald's. Which we had to remake into American Chicken Bunker, our own fast food place. And we had two drive-by shootings.
Wow.
And we had a lot of people coming in looking for work, so it was not a very nice neighborhood. If you go there now, it's beautiful. It's beautiful. And a lot of it has to do with the studios and the films being made in Buffalo, which, of course, then leads to other, the artists come first and then the other people.
Hmm.
And Buffalo's doing very well now. So she's getting a big award. And so we're
congrats.
We're going back there for
congrats
the
to you.
Congrats off mic character.
That's awesome.
So when did you get the confidence that, or did it all happen by default? You're working on these films in New York, and I'm also curious about what it was like to make films in New York back in that period when you were working with Alvinson.
Well, I made movies at Yale. I made two feature-length films at Yale with my Bolex, Bolex, which is a, for your listeners who may not be familiar, Bolex is not a STD.
It's a camera.
Although I've had just about everyone in the book. It's a beautiful Swiss camera that you wind up, and it doesn't shoot synchronized sound. It doesn't have a sync pulse. So the three first features I did, The Girl Who Returned was basically black and white. We would put on the narration track and sound effects and music, but we couldn't. There was no sync sound. Every once in a while, we could sync sound an animal noise or something that was easy to. And in fact, I didn't even have a moviola. I synchronized it on a. I edited it on a synchronizer with rewinds and a synchronizer with a little view. Oop, with a viewer. They had viewers and the 16 millimeter film would run through.
There you go.
And oddly enough, just today, a very famous director of photography who shot for Ed Wood and has done Ray Donovan now and the Roy can't remember his name, but he gave me a vault print of Battle of Love's Return, my first sync sound film.
Oh wow!
In which Oliver Stone was one of the he's in it. He didn't produce it. But it was Lynn Lowry's first movie, and there were some other people in there.
Thanks. Wow.
Yeah, you can't take a shot over 30 seconds with the ball. That's the fun thing about it, you know?
Well, no, the Battle of Love, yeah. So those were the first ones. But the Battle of Love's Return was my first sync sound movie. And Battle of Love's Return, this camera guy, what the heck's his name? We looked him up. He's very famous. Crap. Can you find the top page, please?
Ed Wood for Tim Burton?
Yeah.
That's a beautiful film.
No. He didn't shoot Tim Burton. He shot one of Ed Wood's movies. Way back in the day.
Ed Wood.
Oh. Yeah. And that gave me Wood. But he's done since then. He did one of the Nightmare movies. He did Nightmare on Elm Street movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He did a lot of Ray Donovan's. Roy Wagner. Okay. Oh, yeah.
All right.
Yeah,
he's a big deal. We know.
But cool, this is Battle of Love's Return. We made, you want to go back in time. 1970 was when I made that movie, and it got good reviews in the New York Times, and Judith Crist and played a few theaters. And he had a collection of prints, and he bought a bunch of prints from somebody, and they threw in my movie. And it's a pristine 16-millimeter copy from Movie Lab that I think it was my vault print that somehow ran away from the lab. And how nice, he called me up.
He gave it back to you?
Yeah, he watched it. He said he didn't know what it was, and he watched it and contacted me. He loved it. And I just met him today, and he gave me the print.
Oh, great.
How cool is that?
Wow. Yeah, super cool. You might really need a new version
to come out. What a
nice
guy.
Yeah.
Roy Wagner, what a nice guy. A nice man.
Yeah. Yeah. People who love movies, I think, always want the movies to exist in the right hands, you know? Yeah.
Well, there was another guy about 15 years ago who had a 16-millimeter print, and I bought it back from him. He had bought it online or something. I bought it from him. But this one is in perfect condition.
So after these movies that you had made in college, how did Toxic Avenger happen? So you're working for Canon at this point, and how did
Canon, I got out of it as soon as I learned a little bit, and I started getting jobs to pay the rent and to making my own damn movies.
Mm-hmm.
And we made a movie called Squeeze Play. Well, I met Michael Herz, first of all, and Michael Herz went to Yale but is a couple of years younger. He was going to law school and did not want to be a lawyer. And his wife took her mother to see Cry Uncle in a movie theater and covered up the X rating on it. It came out as an X, even though there were full-page ads in the New York Times for it. And it had about 50 theaters on the break. She put their finger over the X rating. So her mother and she went. And they loved it. They loved Cry Uncle. And they saw that I was one of the not a producer, but I'd raised some of the money. And she saw my big credit. And the next thing, Michael came in, and we decided we'd work together, and we made a movie called Squeeze Play, which was a raunchy women's liberation-themed movie about a softball team. 15 years before the much inferior league of their own. And Squeeze Play did very, very well. And we did three or four raunchy comedies, and then Porky's came along. And, you know, we got in before that trend. And but then the studios started making what we were making, except they were playing very unfair. They were using good scripts and good actors, so we had to go something with something else. And Michael read a headline in Variety. We think it was it was one of the trades saying horror is no longer commercial, and something to that effect. So Michael Hirst said, "That's it. We're going to make a horror film," and but we like comedy, and I like Frankenstein. I always wanted the monster to live, and I can talk for an hour on Toxic Avenger, but it was. Part of it was that what we were doing, even though Squeeze Play, Waitress, Stuck on You, First Turn On, they all had sociological themes to them. The big boys had moved into our turf, so that brought us into the horror area. But we wanted to. We like comedy, which, as you know, comedy is the stupidest thing to do because it's only funny to about six people locally. If whatever's funny in New York isn't going to be funny in L.A., nor is it funny in Italy or India. It is funny in China because they bootleg everything. So they are pigs. They are Chinese pigs over there, and they bootleg everything. It's a fascist, elitist, they're exterminating the Uyghurs and the Tibetans, and their greatest artist is basically in prison. Ai Weiwei. It's a disgrace that Obama even talks to them. Wow. But anyway, enough of that. And I majored in Chinese studies. My dream was to make a movie in China, but they've gone from the. They had the Liberation Wall the first time my wife and I went, which was a democracy wall, they called it. In fact, we put a poster of Squeeze Play up on the democracy wall in 1979, and immediately about 6,000, you know, there was three women in bikinis with baseball gloves. And we had about 6,000 people within 5 minutes. And the cops came. I mean, you know, but we didn't see them take it down. But we ran away just in case. And I think I ran faster than my wife. You know. Run away!
So, knowing that you loved Frankenstein and wanted the monster to live, how did you come up with the concept of the Toxic Avenger himself?
Well, all the trauma movies are based on usually some kind of contemporary theme or sociological issue. And we used to camp a lot. And everywhere we went, there was garbage. And it wasn't biodegradable. The McDonald's plates and cups and the things that hold beer, six packs together, you know. And the thing that really got us was there was a frog whose leg was caught in some kind of plastic stuff. And it was hopping around, and it was horrible. So naturally, I crushed it to death. And we kept, no, that is not true. Not true. In fact, I've done pro bono work for PETA, People's Ethical Treatment of Animals. I made a short for them for free, and pro bono, not to be confused with Cher's bad skiing congressman husband. So I love animals. I clearly love animals. Took Rob a while to get that one.
It's the visual of him hitting a tree.
The visual got me, but that's what your early films just remind me.
So Toxie comes out of this theme of the fact that the earth, this big blue marble, is being defiled, and at the same time, people were going to the gyms, the sports training institutes were coming into fashion. And so the body beautiful on one hand and the destroying the earth on the other. This is 1982, quite a number of years before Al Gore stole the Nobel Peace Prize and invented the internet. So it was way before his environmental genius. And that was pretty much... and then, of course, Preston Sturges, I was going through a huge Preston Sturges kick. And for those of you who are not familiar with him, He was the great satirist. He did five movies in a row that were some of the greatest movies of all time, and he was destroyed by the suits, you know him out here, the ones that like the guy that Fred Zimmerman, who went to did High Noon, went into a studio, and you know, this is when he was in his 70s, and he's got some little guy in a suit. Mr. Zimmerman, tell me about yourself. And then Zimmerman says to the shit in the suit, "You first." Right? so that was the issue there, and anyway, Toxie comes out of all that stuff, and Chaplin, Chaplin in his significant other in City Lights is blind, and and the mop is basically the environmental, you know, cleanup crime.
Did comic books that, like, when I saw it as a kid, it just felt. You know, like, and now comic book movies are the hugest thing on the planet. But it was a marriage of all these. I grew up loving horror movies. I grew up reading comic books and loving it. You mentioned Stan Lee before we were on air before. So did any of that kind of play into it? Did you know?
Yes,
comic book
good
mythology?
Point. I never read comic books as a kid. My folks didn't really have them around, and we weren't allowed to drink Coca-Cola. I remember that. And I'd go over to Oliver Stone's house, and he'd have Pepsi-Cola, and he'd have Scrooge McDuck comics and classic comics, which, of course, I used for my high school book.
He's like
books,
your neighborhood Scarface. Like, no wonder he wrote that. It makes total sense. Like, he's the bad guy corrupting your sensibilities.
We lived our parents were buddies, and in New York, we lived two blocks away from each other. So I would have sleepovers, and he'd beat the crap out of me, and I'd go home crying. And I remember I went home once in my bathrobe. I walked through the streets of New York in my bathrobe and went home. And
Oliver Stone's like a wild one.
Yeah, he was pretty crazy. But we stayed very tight until he became a big success, and then he dropped me, of course.
Yeah.
And the good reason. And at any rate, the comic books, the things I got out of Yale aside, I mean, I majored in Chinese studies, but the two things, drugs and comic books. The guy
at
down
college.
The hall, the guy, the neighbor next to my room had a big collection of Marvel. And they were beautiful, these Spider-Man. I couldn't believe it, how beautiful they were. And as soon as I could, I tracked down Stan Lee. He was living in New York. The Magazine Management was the name of the company. And he gave me a reel-to-reel tape. He said, okay, write a script. And he had some ideas that he put on a reel-to-reel tape recorder. And I listened to it, and I wrote Night of the Witch, which got optioned, oddly enough, by crappy Canon. And they didn't make it, but we got a little dough. And then somebody else optioned it. And then I had it set up at I actually had some guys in Finland who wanted to do it. But by that time, Stan's partner said, no, Stan only is involved in A-quality pictures. So Night of the Witch will never be seen.
It would have been too maudlin if the Finns got their hand on it, you know, those Finns.
It's a great – well, it has to be Stan Lee's Night of the Witch. Mm-hmm. Nobody's interested in Lloyd Kaufman's Night of the Witch except for Lloyd Kaufman. Oh,
and the three people in this room. People.
Yeah.
Hey, you got us.
We're going to watch it.
So, well, it never got made. You know, we got to – somebody's got to put up some dough. Well, I mean, Stan's perfectly happy to have me make it, but his partner, Gil, does not want Stan involved in anything. What Gil may not know is that Stan's in about 10 of my movies. So Stan Lee is in, and he's written introductions to my books. He's the best. He's terrific.
Did you ever?
We saw him yesterday. In fact, Stan met with the mayor of Los Angeles yesterday, and Regina, who's head of the whole Stan Lee Comic-Con, was wearing the Toxic Avenger for President button with the mayor of Los Angeles and Stan Lee, which I thought was very cool.
Yeah.
Is this going to be a popular write-in in 7 days? You know?
I'm going to write them in, I'll tell you that.
I was going to ask, you know, at the time, the thing I love about all your films is you know, your wit for satire is brilliant. Like, all the way up to Poltergeist, I remember watching things, and there were so many modern relevant jokes and things that you poked fun at that I, you know, you've always had a sharp sense of humor in terms of what's going on in the world. For going back to Toxic Avenger, like, you were really pushing the envelope on so many levels. Whether, you know, with gore, the humor, the things you were poking fun at.
The sexuality.
Yeah. And I was a kid at the time, so I have no idea. It was like a rite of passage finding this movie because it was unlike anything I'd seen, and it was the one that went too far. And that's why we would have it as, you know, sleepover party movies, like you have to watch this movie.
Check out Return to Nuke 'Em High and Return to Nuke 'Em High, which is a two-part movie.
I like part one. When's part two coming
out? Part two is crazier. It's the second half of the movie, and we're doing the sound design now. So I think you'll be very happy.
I like the first one a lot. In fact, I thought it had a great lesbian love story.
Yes.
That I really felt for.
Yeah, yeah. So. Well, thank you. And they have wonderful actors. Catherine Cochran and Asta Parides are terrific. I mean, and they're hot as hell. I mean, the lesbian scenes, never mind how good the movie is, just that alone. With Toxic Avenger, every convention I go to, everything, for 30 years, there's always a 13-year-old kid who comes up and whispers in my ear that, Mr. Coffin, you know, that was the first time I whacked off, Mr. Kaufman. The scene in the theme room. The theme room, Mr. Kaufman. Thanks, buddy.
See, for me, it was Leroy's mama in Surf Nazis Must Die.
Well, I can't. Peter George's movie, but we were the only ones who bought
it.
Same with Trey Parker and Matt Stone. None of the idiots out here.
Oh,
knew.
Cannibal was the musical. I remember
none
that.
Of them.
Yeah,
we were the first on the train to. We were the first stop on the train for. We were the first ones to seize on it, and of course Trey and Matt wanted money, which we don't have. And then nobody got it. None of the all these people out here. When you go to Comedy Central, we always wanted that film. It's bullshit. Nobody would touch it.
Yeah.
And Trey and Matt certainly didn't want to go with Troma, but they had to because it was the last stop, and they were very happy.
We have an article that went up on Blumhouse.com today about the history behind Cannibal the Musical, the Alfred Packard story,
which
I'd never heard before, but it's like a real-life cannibal in Colorado that they based the musical off of.
Oh, at the university, the cafeteria is called Alfred Packard.
Yeah, that's what I read.
Oh, that's funny.
And Stan Brakhage was the only professor. Did they talk about Stan Brakhage?
No, Colorado, I don't think so.
He was the only professor who gave them any encouragement, and he's in Cannibal the Musical too.
Greatest visual artist
of all time, in my opinion. Got what Trey and Matt were doing, understood it, and encouraged them. Nobody
Colorado? He taught in Colorado.
Yeah, I remember. Yeah, nobody else understood him. And Trey told me when I interviewed him on the set of the marionette movie, Team America, he said Troma's the only one so far that gave them any profit participation checks.
Hmm.
So how cool is that?
Period, what was the biggest boom period financially for, you know, because all these different models have, you know, boom and bust periods of the changing industry constantly, but was it right after Toxie where that was just hitting in terms of, and also the VHS market. And what was like the perfect time period for what you were doing and how many movies you guys could make? Because, you know, obviously I see it in Corman's, you know, work as well. The models keep changing. And what you're doing now, ironically, I just heard a podcast last night with Mark Duplass of the Duplass Brothers. And what you've been doing all this time is now what he says is the only way of the future, which is to own all your material and brand yourself and don't do bigger studio stuff. Because in the long run, it's going to be a bunch of like three big companies and they're all going to just have to license stuff to stream. And that's kind of his prediction of the future. And it made me laugh because I was thinking about you coming on and you've been doing that for 30 years.
Here's a bit of news for your fans. The Duplass brothers, their very first movie is a Troma movie that we bought.
Really?
But they don't want it distributed. And we're nice guys.
Is it before the Puffy Chair? One made before that?
No. It's the first feature length movie.
Okay.
Yeah. But they don't want us to distribute it. And because not only we respect the artists, so we're not distributing it until they tell us. They told us they wanted us to wait till after the one where the guy's bowels, they did one with...
The butt thing. It was the horror thing last year.
The one about the little creature that lives in his intestine? Milo.
Bad Milo.
Wait until Milo's out or something.
It's out.
I know. But well, then I called them and no answer. But they are in one of my books. I interviewed them in one of my books. And I filmed them also. The interview should be up on... Troma's movie channel on YouTube. Troma, by the way, to thank our fans like you, Troma has put up. We're putting up all our movies on Troma movies on YouTube. All free. It's all free, and also my short videos, make your own damn movie videos that illustrate my books. It's all there for free, as well as political.
But this is what I mean. You're unlike a lot of filmmakers. You are able to brand what you do, and never be off point with that brand.
Yeah.
Well, that was the original idea: was to make low budget movies, put something in the movie that would be commercial, but then try to change the world a little bit. And to some extent, we've done it.
And what period was it? The period between the Toxic, like one and two, where that as a mini studio?
No, fuck no. Squeeze Play was huge.
Oh, really?
Huge. Huh. Nobody ever saw anything like it.
Yeah.
And in fact, no theater, like every movie we do, no theater would play it. And then I was down in Virginia where we were involved in producing a movie with Kirk Douglas and Martin Sheen and Catherine Ross and a few others. And I got the theater to agree to put in AMC. They agreed to try a sneak preview with the Squeeze Play. It played with the Odd Cup. No, it played with the Peter Falk movie. With
In-laws?
In-laws, exactly. Oh. Right.
Elric's good.
Wow. I got a combo.
Congrats, Elric is amazing. You're amazing. And the audience went nuts. And the next Monday, AMC wanted to book the movie in all their movie theaters.
Oh, wow.
We had like one print. You know, I think we had eight prints or something. So we started there in Norfolk, and it ran, I think, 7 or 8 weeks in about eight theaters. And then Squeeze Play took off. And then Waitress, when it opened in New York, had 90. I remember to this day, they had in the New York City 92 theaters, 92 screens in the New York metropolitan area. Now, when we play a movie like Poultrygeist, one screen.
I remember seeing that one in New York. I saw, I think we were in East Side. I saw it with you, if I remember correctly.
Village.
Was it Two Boots?
Village. No, not Poultrygeist. Poultrygeist was in the Village East.
You're right. Had a big marquee out front, I remember that.
Yeah.
But did the theatrical matter as much when the VHS boom finally did catch up, which is, I guess, always, Toxie,
it always.
Right?
Well, our fans like theatrical. They like the communal viewing.
We do too.
We just came back from Santa Ana where the Toxic Avenger was played Thursday night, and it was packed. The place was Frida Theater.
Mm-hmm.
Frida Theater, which is an independent. The place was packed. They didn't have enough seats. And here's a 30-year-old movie. And they didn't, you know, sometimes they have to show 35 millimeter like the New Beverly here.
Mm-hmm.
They showed a Blu-ray. It wasn't even, bullshit 35 scratched up film, which the Museum of Modern Art, which just showed Romeo and Juliet about 3 days ago. But just before we came here, they put Romeo and Juliet in their Shakespeare series. I agree. But it took them 20 years to get that, and they had to have 35 millimeter, and the print was horrible. It would the Blu-ray looks great.
So you're definitely on the camp, because this is like a real bifurcating argument in Hollywood. You're okay with showing your stuff on Blu-ray.
Yeah, why not? It looks so much better than 35 millimeter. I mean, if you have good prints, fine. But I know that Scorsese is restoring Lawrence of Arabia and all that, but nobody's restoring our movies, and we don't have a pot to pee in. So how are we going to strike a brand new print of Romeo and Juliet for the museum?
What was the last film you shot on film on 35?
Poultrygeist, Night of the Chicken Dead.
And then it's just all digital now.
We finance a bunch of younger people, but the first film that I shot, which was digital, was Return to Newcomb High and Return to Newcomb High, a.k.a. Volume 2, which was shot on the Alexa, which is a wonderful camera.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is it's more expensive to get that camera than our 35-millimeter cameras.
Oh,
On Poultrygeist, we had three 35-millimeter cameras. This one, we had one camera. So that
Kodak will now, like, give you the camera. They'll be like, oh, just take our camera and shoot on film. We want you to shoot film.
Yeah, and the insurance on the digital ones are insane. That's what always kills us.
Well, the price of the digital, of the Alexa, was insane. So we couldn't afford anything else.
Interesting.
Now, from just a pure, like, directorial standpoint, which one did you find to be more, like, fun on set? Did you like shooting digital?
Certainly
since
digital.
You've done, like, a whole career on 35.
Up until Return to Newcomb High and Return to Newcomb High, I was wedded to 35 millimeter. But digital is better now. There's no question that digital is better. It's better. It looks better, and it is better. So I'm all for digital, but it took me a while. In fact, my book, Make Your Own Damn Movie, one of the writers was Trent Haga, and he and I have this huge, vicious fight about, he's trying to tell me that digital is better, and then it wasn't, for sure it wasn't, but he insisted that it was better, and eventually during the book we start hating each other. Not, we don't
he's
really
been,
hate
he's
each
been
other.
On Trent's been on the show.
Trent's the best. Yeah, he's going to be the next James Gunn who comes out of Troma, because he's just written and directed a wonderful film with the guy from Criminal Minds and another
Goobler.
Star.
Yeah, Goobler.
Goobler, yeah.
I've seen it.
Who's also a huge Troma fan. Goobler loves Troma. Oh,
yeah.
Pat and I visited the set in New Orleans, and Goobler ran off in the middle of a take. And
who's the most surprising person who you've discovered was a fan of these movies that you just wouldn't have expected to? Like Anthony Weiner or something? I don't know. You're in New York, I'm guessing.
George Bush was in my class.
Really?
Yeah, he was a very complimentary. For our 25th year, we were invited to the White House for a
really?
Reception. Oh, my gosh.
Well, it was a reunion, the 25th Yale reunion.
Uh-huh. Oh.
And he said, how's Toxie doing? So he knew it.
I love
wow.
that.
Wow.
I want to see the badge on him.
Yeah, know? I want him to be wearing the Toxie for president.
Oh, I would bet he's there for Toxie.
Yeah, yeah.
There's the fans have put up President Toxie on Twitter, and he's got President Toxie has a few hundred followers on
so
Twitter.
If there's a recount, he
it's
could
fans
slip.
Who, yeah. I'm voting for Toxie, I'll tell you that.
There's been so many people that have come through and come up and gotten their start from Troma, you know, James Gunn, obviously the Eli Roth is one of the people that has done stuff.
Costner had a cameo.
Just so many people.
If you want to hear a good commentary track, listen to the commentary on Bloodsucking Freaks Blu-ray. It's Eli Roth. He did the DVD back before he was Eli Roth, and he's terrific. And he was so excited about it that we let him do it. We didn't know who he was. He was a graduate student who was Gabe Friedman's advisor when Gabe was at NYU. And Eli was really aggressive about doing the Bloodsucking Freaks commentary. It's terrific. It's really good. He loves movies. In fact, Mother's Day, my brother's movie, is his favorite horror film. And he says it. I've interviewed him where he said it twice. And he goes into detail about the art direction, which my sister did, and my sister Susan. And he's a real movie. He loves movies. He's terrific, and he's in a few of our movies.
Yeah, when you cross paths with these young filmmakers like that, I mean, what's funny about James Gunn, you know, all through his filmography with Slither and things like that, I still see a lot of Troma in his movies.
Yeah, it still feels Troma,
which is amazing.
Well, he says that he channels me whenever he's. It doesn't matter what the budget is. He channels me, whatever he's doing. And on Guardians of the Galaxy, we were on set. I have 2 seconds. You can see me for 2 seconds in the Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yeah.
Murderer! That's my big line. But he said to his whole group that, after he talked about I gave him his first job, he wasn't going to be a filmmaker either. He was writing books.
He wanted to be a novel.
But his novel is great. The Collector is terrific. It's a wonderful, it's terrific. You should read it. It's about a kid who sells drugs so he can buy toys. Most people would sell the toys so they can buy drugs. It's a wonderful, dark, it's James Gunn all the way.
Yeah.
And he said to everybody there, including the two stars, Zoe and Pratt, the guy from Henry.
Rooker.
Rooker.
Yeah, he said, and there was thousands of them. You saw that set. I still channel Lloyd Kaufman no matter what I'm doing. Discipline, responsibility, blah, blah, blah. To thine own self be true kind of thing.
Yeah, and is that the kind of, that's the kind of running an actual company, not just making the movies, because there's a whole other side to it. How difficult has that been to keep going over all these years, and how to maintain a brand and try to keep the integrity of what you've been, the reason you've been wanting to make these movies? How different is Troma now versus Troma 20 years ago?
Oh, it's infinitely harder. We're more famous now. I mean, people recognize me in the street. And yet it's infinitely harder to reach an audience because the rules that used to protect the public against monopoly have been done away with. And the rules so the industry is very, very consolidated. And there's really, if you want to make money, you have to join up with one of the vassals of one of the devil-worshipping international media conglomerates. And I really hope I can join up with one.
Well, you're in L.A.,
after
so it's a good chance.
Yeah.
No, I hate them. Michael Herz and I hate them. And
But that's what I mean. You've stayed independent all this time.
Yeah. We're the.
That's your lingo.
42
that's your logo.
Years. Yeah.
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 Real independence.
And soon I'll be wearing real Depends. So it all works out. And but they're remaking Toxic Avenger. Akiva Goldsman is. He won the Oscar.
A Beautiful Mind. Yeah.
Yeah. They just signed.
Was Schwarzenegger?
Well, Schwarzenegger was.
Yeah, they signed Schwarzenegger, but they announced it at the Cannes Film Festival, and was a big headline in Variety and Hollywood Reporter. It was on the front page, and suddenly I'm walking around the Croisette at Cannes, and people are, hey, they're being nice to me, and then 2 weeks later, Schwarzenegger unsigned. And I'm not sure exactly what happened, but that's how it works in the media, I imagine. Contracts mean nothing. Yeah. And they did sign, however, to direct the guy who did Sausage Party. And he's very good. Nice. He's a huge Troma fan. He saw Terra Firma and Tromeo and Juliet and Vernon. I can't remember his name, but I met him a couple of times. He loves Troma, and Sausage Party sure was Troma-esque. Yeah. So if they get it together and they actually make the movie, I think we'll be in good hands. Certainly the musical, the Toxic Avenger musical, written by music by David Bryan of Bon Jovi and Joe DiPietro, who's a Tony-winning writer of Broadway shows. They did a great job. I love it. My wife and I have seen Toxic Avenger the musical in London, Houston, L.A. We ran a year in New York, won every award for Off-Broadway. We saw it in Long Island. I mean, it's playing all over the place. And in New York, it went over a year. So it's a really good musical.
Mm. I wanted to ask you about, because you mentioned the Toxic Avenger remake. In general, when people approach you about remaking Troma properties, because I remember several years ago when I initially interviewed you, you had at the time said, oh, well, Brett Ratner really wants to make Mother's Day. I remember I posted that online and everybody laughed and made fun of me. They're like, "That Lloyd didn't say that. That's not true at all." Lo and behold, Brett Ratner remade Mother's Day. So you were telling the truth.
With Darren
Bousman, a good friend of ours.
Right. And apparently it's a good film. The fans seem to – nobody's complained about it. The fans seem to like it.
It's not the original. It's very different. But it's good for being its own product. It's good for what it is.
And because they wanted my brother and I to do a little cameo so that the fanboys would shut up. We went up to Winnipeg and did it. And on the set of Winnipeg, one of the guys who made Father's Day for us gave me the idea that, Mother's Day project is what led to Father's Day, which has nothing to do with Mother's Day. And I thought it would be hilarious if we produced a movie called Father's Day taking advantage of Mother's Day. And if you see Father's Day, it's about butt-fucking fathers. It's about people who fuck fathers up the ass. And it has nothing to do with with my brother's movie. And it's a great film. Father's Day is terrific. Those guys are so talented.
It's a wonderful fucking films you'll see.
Yeah, but I guess what I'm asking is at that time when you told us about Mother's Day, you're like,
is that kind of language acceptable here?
Sure. It is totally.
Because I went to Yale. Sure. I know a lot of good vocabulary.
You're good.
Thanks to Yale.
You had said, if somebody like Brett Ratner wants to make Mother's Day, that's fine if there's a payday in it, but if James Gunn came to you, if Eli Roth came to you, you'd give them Troma movies.
I'd run
of
coffee for them. I'd give it to them for nothing. Sure. Right. In fact, Brett Ratner originally called me up and called me buddy and wanted the rights for nothing. And eventually we got a big payday.
Good.
Took a year or two. But,
glad.
Good. So, I mean, do a lot of people still approach you about remaking some
of
your
properties? Yeah, they want to redo Poultrygeist.
Really? That's only 10 years old, right? Yep. Not even.
Yeah.
I'll cut a check right now for Sergeant Kabuki Man, NYPD. Right now. You name your price.
Good luck.
Because that was a heck of a concept, that one.
But but Return to Newcombe High, that wasn't even my idea. That was a guy at Starz who grew up with Troma, and it was his idea to remake our movies. And so I agreed. Obviously, it had to be on a low budget, but they agreed no censorship. So Starz and Anchor Bay, perfectly good. They put it in some theaters. They they lived up to their end. And they only have the first half of the movie. The second half, we're on our own. That guy's moved on to somewhere else.
Now, on the
great list, guy, though. He loves movies.
We got a list when we were talking with your assistant about some of the projects that you have coming up, and I saw The Tempest on there. Please tell me you're going back to Shakespeare.
I think so. I think I'm trying to figure out how it's a perfect movie for
me. It's wonderful.
It's about old people and dreams and drugs.
Crazy yeah. daughters and yeah. revenge. And yeah, it's such a wonderful story and a monster.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And the idea would be to have a made up character, Toxie, playing a made up character, Caliban, playing a real monster. You know, it would be kind of interesting. And then have Kabuki Man, a made up character, playing Ariel. And I would play Prospero if I can't find an old person who can act, whose acting sucks less than mine. I think it's a good one because it's all about losing powers and getting old and dreams and drugs. And so I think The Tempest will be pretty interesting. I just have to figure out how to, you know, the beginning. You know, it took a long time with Dromio because it's got to be something we really love because it's, you know, it's not exactly commercial.
Yeah. Now, you just mentioned Universe.
By the way, John Brennan, sorry to interrupt, but John Brennan, my assistant, he produces Kabuki Man's Cocktail Corner. And if any of you go to Troma's movie channel on YouTube, it's all free. And we're in our second series. It's a sketch show, and it's very funny. It's doing very well, Kabuki Man's Cocktail Corner. So Kabuki Man lives even now, years later.
Nice.
And, of course, he had a big featured role in... In Citizen Toxie, mm-hmm. The Toxic Avenger Part 4. He should have been nominated for Best Supporting Actor, but life is cruel.
It's rigged.
Yes!
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to ask, because Elric mentioned Universe, and that's one thing that always existed in the Troma films, is they all kind of took place in this same universe, much of it in this same kind of guttural New York setting, but now that setting, that guttural kind of gritty New York is gone. Is the kind of universe setting transitioning with it?
Well, no, because Tromaville is a fictitious New Jersey. you know, our movies are all about the underdog, and New Jersey itself is an underdog. So pretty much everything we shoot takes place in this really sad little town called Tromaville, where the little people are victims of elites, corporate elite, the bureaucratic elite, and the labor elites, mm-hmm. you know, union leaders who make millions of dollars while their members are eating dog food. And those three elites suck dry the little people of Tromaville of their economic and spiritual capital. And sometimes the little people of Tromaville need Kabuki Man, who lives over in the water in Tromaville on the waterfront, to help them out. Sometimes they call upon Toxie, who lives in the dump at Tromaville, and sometimes they have to do it themselves. Troma's war. The little people at Tromaville had to save the free world. But they're all... But where do you think I got the universe from? That's Stan Lee all mm-hmm. the way, yeah. You know, Marvel. We just had... In fact, Stan Lee said in one of the intros that the Toxic Avenger, in the same way that Spider-Man put a new face on the comic book superhero, Toxie put a new face on the movie superhero. And if you see Deadpool, those guys are huge Troma fans. And they really did a great job. That's a wonderful film.
Hadn't thought about that. Makes total sense when I think about it. Yeah.
Well, they even do the Brechtian thing. I mean, I've been having my characters talk to the
fourth wall.
That was a great. I love that in Deadpool that they did that.
Yeah.
And it's become stylish. When we used to do it, people used to lambast us for. Breaking the fourth wall, and now it's very popular. It's great, right? House of Cards, all these things.
Yeah.
Do it. You know, I mean, obviously, I got it from Brecht. I didn't invent it, but you know, it was not popular in the day.
Do you still get excited when it comes to actually directing? Because I have a vague memory of when you were making Poltergeist, which is now. I think it was 2006, you saying that that would be your last time directing a movie.
I thought, I thought that my swan song was going to be a chicken movie.
Yes.
But
you didn't care which one.
But I just thought, how am I going to get the money to get, you know, our movies cost about $400,000 or $500,000. So how am I going to do that again? Uh-huh. And Poltergeist, even though it's a wonderful movie, and if you talked, I mean, Neville Dean and Taylor, the Crank guys, I'm in that movie. On Gamer, they came to see. They were doing Gamer, and Troma Dance was in. Fans were putting on Troma Dance Film Festival in Albuquerque, one of the theaters there was playing Poltergeist, and I was there that night, and they showed up, Neville Dean and Taylor, and they both were saying to the audience. I had them come up and say something, and they said, "In a fair world, Poltergeist should have made a shitload of money, but unfortunately, Poltergeist." my wife's retirement money financed it. Was we lost a lot of money on it. It's very hard to hard to get to penetrate the hymen of the mainstream without you getting fucked. And it's a different world.
I want that quote on the box.
It's a very different world. Thank you, Rebecca. It's a different. It's a different world. I mean, it really is tough. And Michael Herz and I are there because we love movies. And that's really what propelled us. That was what fueled us from the beginning. And luckily, we have a big, I can't say big, but we've got a big cult. For cults, we have a big fan base. Right. And our fans really. That's why we're giving all our movies away. Troma movies on YouTube. Everything, not the world premiere movies, not the newest, but everything up to there, we're giving them away for free. And they're all, every day we put up new movies or new short films or new make-your-own-damn-movie lessons. And if you subscribe, you get an email or an alert. And it's great. The fans love it. And we owe them everything, especially now.
So many people are saying that that's the model of the future because of the internet that we're not used to paying for things anymore. Like we watch things for free. Even if you're getting Netflix and you pay a couple bucks a month, you don't think about the cost.
Feels free.
Yeah, Netflix, it feels free.
Even though it's not.
So I'm hearing a lot of people.
Yeah, I never watch Netflix even though I'm paying $8 a month. I watch it maybe once a month and it's like, what am I doing?
That's why they have all that money.
Yeah. And I'm too lazy to disengage. You know?
That's how I am. I don't watch my Hulu very much, but I keep it because I'm like, maybe I'll watch it someday. Yeah, it's $5. Services. Come on.
Well, it's a pain to disengage. We have our own Netflix called Troma Now, which is all world premiere movies, and then I curate about 10 movies from our library every month, and it's $4.99, I think, a month. But it so we do have that if anybody, you know, if people are rich, but our fans are pretty poor. So
what services does it go through? Do you know offhand?
Everything.
Okay.
It's on a platform called VHX TV, but it's on the Roku. Whatever. It's easily available.
Right. You know what? The other thing I want to ask you about is this. As long
it's subscription. It's a subscription thing. Right. First month is free if anybody out there wants to try it. First month, Troma Now on VHX.
Right. You were talking about how important the fan base has been in keeping Troma going. As long as I've been going to horror conventions since I was a little kid, you've always had a presence there. Troma's always had a presence. How is and I mean, it seems like that's an important thing to you to be out and meeting people. How has the convention kind of circuit changed for you over the course of the last 10, 20 years or whatever it is?
Well, the conventions, for the most part, are still nerd-fueled, and the fans are great. The nicest fans in the world are the sci-fi, horror, pop culture fans. Mm-hmm. The San Diego Comic-Con, which we have taken booths there, I think, more than 30 years, that has become like the Cannes Film Festival. It is really not a Comic-Con. I mean, it's totally different. It's all about mainstream TV and the big movies.
Who can make the biggest splash and have the splashiest island in the middle of the con.
Yeah. That's right, yeah. I mean, I think some of the companies are spending over $1 million on it. It's like Natby was in the day where Disney would spend over $1 million on their booth. And they'd serve fresh shrimp and everything. And the Troma, we'd go from our little booth, we'd go over to Fox and get in the line and eat lunch there and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. So, but most of the conventions are still, we do about 30 of them, maybe a little more. And I don't go to too many, but we have people who handle the East Coast and up to the Mississippi. We have a guy in Georgia and Florida, and then we have people who handle the West for us. And
Megan's phenomenal.
Megan and Marcus. They love you. They
love Megan
you.
And Marcus. Yeah. They are wonderful people.
We didn't know you were at, they were setting, they did the book. Sorry. I'm very Mediterranean. I use my hands when I speak.
It's okay.
When I speak, I keep knocking the mic. But they were talking about you and they love you. Megan and Marcus, they love you.
No, Megan's wonderful. So they both are. I'll have to hunt them down at the next con. But speaking of you at conventions, so I was at Days of the Dead last year and had the most inspirational Troma moment where I'm sitting at the booth and I was there signing with Etheria, the Etheria Film Festival, and sitting next to me is this girl, like barely a teenager, and she says, I just directed my first movie for Troma and I've always wanted to like talk to you. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. You let like a 13-year-old direct a movie, and that is amazing.
Well, she
and
wasn't 13, yeah. but you're close.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm not that far off.
Let me give context to this story.
Back check.
No.
Well, we've always been very receptive to people who are really eager to get involved with us, and the big mistake was Michael Herz, who somehow managed to turn down Madonna, who was desperate to work on, to be in First Turn On. She made her own costume for auditions. It was a summer camp movie. It's Vincent D'Onofrio's first movie. And Michael somehow, it was not what was in his head. Instead, he picked someone who couldn't act. That was apparently what was in his head.
Turn a negative into a positive. We were too good for Madonna.
Yeah, well, she owes us. She owes us. Had we accepted her, the Adams might have gone differently, and she might have been, not where she is. And when we gave her the kiss off, I was not there. I think it was during Cannes. She said to Michael and Ilan, the assistant director, I'm going to be a big star in the music world. I'm going to be a star. And they were like, oh, well, good luck. You're a nice person.
Wow.
6 months later, she was on the cover of Newsweek magazine or something like that. And the First Turn On was kind of underwhelming people at the time. Although the First Turn On is hilarious. If anybody wants to see a funny, raunchy, R-rated movie, that is it. And Vincent D'Onofrio is hilarious in it.
Yeah,
but so Kansas Bowling is her name.
That's
it.
Kansas.
She was 15. When she somehow got my email. She got my email. She was very aggressive. She came to New York with her mother to visit Tromaville. I wasn't there, but she had someone take pictures of her at my desk. And my desk is got a lot of crap. It's a kind of interesting set.
I have pictures of me at your desk.
Oh, yeah. Thanks, Rebecca.
I do.
Well, thank you. And so she sent the picture, and then we met, and I gave her some money. And she made B.C. Butcher, and with no strings attached. I didn't say you have to give it to Troma to distribute. Good luck. And thank me when you get the Oscar. And then we ended up distributing, and we're distributing now. But it got a big red carpet. It's the only movie in Troma history that's gotten its own red carpet. And at the Egyptian, it was a great evening. And she's terrific. I think she'll be the next, not the next one, but she will be in line after James Gunn and Eli Roth and Samuel Jackson and all those guys.
Yeah, she was absolutely wonderful to talk to her at
a convention.
Yeah,
she's hilarious.
She's great.
And incredibly directed, incredibly hardworking. Not afraid to go out and sell her movie, which is a big problem for many young filmmakers who think that art shouldn't be mixed with promotion. She's the perfect Troma. She's great. And the people that she, all her actors and crew, they love her. So check out B.C. Butcher. It's on Troma now, and it's really good. And the first month is free, so you could see it for free. And here she is. She's now 20 or 19. How old is she? 20, I think, right? She just turned 20. Oh. And she's directing. She directed a few. She did the new music video with the Death Valley Girls. And she's her boyfriend, Rodney Bingenheimer, of course, is a major player in the music world. Mm-hmm. So he's opened some doors for her. And she's great. I think she will be a really great contender.
Do you have like a vision for Troma, like going like 20 years from now, like way in the future, do you have a vision for somebody who is up and coming who you would entrust the, you know, the keys to the kingdom of Troma and the vision of what it's going to become?
I think Troma has a life of his own. Certainly the Toxic Avenger.
Yeah.
All the movies and cartoons and toys and all that goes on.
On its own.
Doesn't matter who. I think Troma will somehow go along. I don't think anybody involved with Troma is going to want to be in fact, I was buddies with Sam Arkoff, who Nicholson started American International Pictures.
Yeah.
And
his biggest regret,
he actually, Sam was the first one who wanted to remake The Toxic Avenger, so that goes way back.
Wow.
And a very nice man. But his big regret was that he sold his company. And, obviously everybody's got a price, but I think somebody will... we have three daughters who are in the movie area, and Charlotte Kaufman has got a movie on Netflix now called Undecided, which is, in fact, if you want to see something funny about the election, watch Undecided. Lisbeth Kaufman has a startup called Kit Split, which Hearst is helping to finance, And it's been around for 2 or 3 years. It's an Airbnb for film and video equipment. So if there are filmmakers out there, they're out here in L.A. and New York and Philadelphia and Boston. It's a new idea, but it's insured and
you're being fact checked by your
and
wife.
It's terrific. And yes,
1 year and a few months.
Oh, it's only been around for 1 year and a few months. But the idea was founded when they were at business school at Stern. And so but it's a new thing.
It's a great idea.
And then the older Lily Hayes Kaufman wrote a script that NBC bought, and she's written stuff for us. So my guess is my wife is only 32, so she'll go on for a while. And my wife would never sell it. So and Michael Herz is going to go on for nothing's going to. He's a cyborg, so, so nothing's going to.
I'm not going anywhere.
But we do think about that, and what do you do? I think we have 800 movies. Not all, 100 of them we made maybe. But there's so many short pieces we've done and political things and cartoons. And
you guys own just a lot of property, like Bloodsucking Freaks and things like that.
Yeah, we own a lot of movies. When we had money, I wanted to buy drugs, but Michael said, let's buy movies. So we've bought all these libraries of companies who died, not because they're bad movies, but because it's so difficult to get to the public, to get Clinton got rid of the financial syndication rule, which ended the independent film getting on television in any way. Huh. And that allowed the financial syndication rule required that the networks buy a third of their content from independents. And so that put the end on, and it also permitted NBC and CBS to own movies. They could own the content. That was against the FCC rules prior to that. And now the establishment wants to get rid of net neutrality on the internet, which means that, I don't know about you guys, but pretty much anyone else who's truly independent, you guys may be strong enough to be able to go to the superhighway that they want to build, the phone companies and the big conglomerates. Want to have a super highway for the rich and powerful, and then the rest of us are going to be on a dirt road on the internet, and which takes a lot of time to buffer, and that will certainly be the end of a lot of innovation and a lot of good movies and a good movie companies. But we bought collections of movies from companies that unfortunately went out of business due to the consolidation of the media. Mm-hmm. Right now, you've got 40% of the American media owned and controlled by a white 80-year-old guy who's probably racist and sexist, and another white guy who's 93 years old, who we know is a sexual pervert, through at least based on the newspaper reports. Yeah. That's my opinion, by the way. I don't want to get sued.
Disclaimer.
But it's they've got him in sex film. The newspapers say he did sex tapes. Viacom and Fox, 40%. Are owned by white old guys. And where's Will Smith with his Oscar So White, right? He's a big shot when it comes to mouthing off. But he's a puppy dog of those guys. Why didn't he talk about them? I did. On Troma Movies on YouTube. We did Toxie and I and Kabuki Man and Tromets. We did a great riff on a rant on the Oscar So White. But that's the problem, the consolidation. So many companies, even with great movies, can't survive. And most people want to make money. Most people, we love movies. So, and we've got our fans who kind of keep us alive.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What is some of the stuff that's coming up that you're most excited about in the not too distant future for Trump? I mean, obviously the second part of Newcomb High.
Return to Newcomb High is going to be great. It really is. It's the epitome of trauma, and our fans will love it. We're making a movie in Portugal by Fernando Ale, who made Banana Motherfucker, which we are distributing. And it's
may be the greatest name
ever. Good title.
Banana Motherfucker. I don't know why it didn't get into Walmart or Best Buy, but get the DVD. It's on Trauma Movies. You can see it for free, I think. Yes. It's hilarious. He worked on some of our movies as special effects, but he's Portuguese, and we gave him some money, and the Portuguese government has given him some money, even knowing it's a trauma movie. It's called Mutant Blast, and it's going to start shooting pretty soon. And I think they start in 2017, but I've got photos of these. It's a, kind of a buddy picture. There's a big lobster and a big rat and some hot female soldiers and stuff like that. But it's Troma, but younger and really good special practical effects. You know, he loves practical effects. So that it's going to – and the good news is, just in case it might be successful, we're doing it in the Portuguese language. So it'll be the first Troma movie in a language that nobody speaks. So that's going to be very cool. Going to be a big hit, international hit. Yeah, Portugal has about six.
In Brazil, there's a little Portuguese.
Brazil is all bootlegs. Yeah. There is no distribution in Brazil other than the big boys. There's nothing there for us. But we're there to get our movies out. Yeah. We would love to make money, and we have made money. But the purpose of art is for people to look at it. So the most valuable thing that anybody has, and you're giving it to the commissioner and me right now, is time. Time. Money's not the what's valuable. It's the time is much more valuable. So, and I say that in my book, Sell Your Own Damn Movie, which at this point, when did I not write that book? Well, I get young people. I work with young people. They do all the work, and I take the credit. That's a very good lesson
business.
For you.
Interns.
You guys, we need to get interns to write a book about us.
Yes, I want James Gunn to write my book.
How long ago was that?
5 or 6 years
ago. Yeah, it was 5 or 6 years ago, and it really anticipates the notion of how foolish so many people are with these passwords and Vimeo. You know, I get these people want me to look at their movie, and then the password is so complicated, and I don't want to erase what I've already got copied in my computer. So I just don't, you know, I have to either write down the number, you know, it's so stupid. Just put it up and or make an easy password, you know, whatever. You know, nobody's going to steal their movie. And then after that, they want to try to get people to look at the movie, and nobody's there. Nobody wants to see it. So time is the most valuable thing. And that's what we're all after, eyeballs. People who want to see art. That's what it's about. Not Van Gogh didn't paint to make a lot of money, right? He cut his ear off, and that's about it. And meanwhile, now he was not a promoter. I'm a promoter. Picasso was a promoter, and Picasso did financially very, very well. And Van Gogh, arguably just as good as Picasso, never sold a painting except one to his brother, I think. That was it. Now he's, you know, Van Gogh is up there with Picasso, maybe higher.
Yeah, his problem was sex tapes. Van Gogh sex tape.
Yeah. Well, I was at the Van Gogh Museum a while back.
This is going to stick. I'm going to be in a serious situation, and I'm going to say Van Gogh.
Teaching a class next week, and I'm going to be like, and Van Gogh's work. Yeah.
Well, I was there when we were making Poultrygeist, and I swear, Van Gogh, I was kind of crying. It was so beautiful. The museum is gorgeous, and his sad life and all that stuff. And I vowed to put Van Gogh into Poultrygeist somehow, but Gabe Friedman, with whom I wrote that, he thought it was stupid. And I imagine he's right. It didn't make sense.
I was actually listening to, or was I reading something? I swear it was an NPR piece that I heard last week about how now research has proven that Van Gogh did not actually cut his ear off to, like, send to his lover or something like that. It was purely for attention because it was, like, timed right as his brother said that his brother was getting married and they were considering cutting off because they'd been financially supporting him. And, like, the next day he cut his ear off and was like, I cut my ear off. You have to keep supporting me.
Well, so by the way, like, it was not his ear he cut off either. According to NPR, he cut off his penis. And I heard it, I believe it was
really?
Donna Bazile who said that.
Gave him the answers.
Yeah, just exactly. Just before she got all the game.
I loved her work on Banana Motherfucker. Donna Brazile, your work on Banana Motherfucker was something special.
And she speaks Portuguese, Brazil, right?
Yeah,
okay.
It's
amazing. It's terrific.
God, I want to have an episode where we just talk in absurdities.
I love this idea.
Just go to Hillary's cast of characters. You got Homer, you got Wiener, you got Brazil, you've got...
Talking about horror films, I watched Wiener last night, and I couldn't even believe... That thing is just... It's one of the most bonkers stories I've ever seen in my life. The access to a person
wonderful?
Just opening their life to you in a terrible situation. It's just
and meanwhile,
train
here
wreck.
He is again, maybe a big force in history.
Could have changed the whole election. You never
it's
know.
Fascinating. It's fascinating.
So, we'll know in a week.
Wow.
Well, next episode.
Okay, guys.
When you think about Wiener and WikiLeaks, Wiener leaks... Yeah. Leaks with wieners. Yeah. It's pretty interesting. Yeah, it's almost.
This
it's
is
almost
me reining it back in, boys. Yeah. Oh, reining it back
in. I think this is a pitch session for the next Troma movie. Wiener leaks. It's a no brainer.
Maybe Blumhouse would be interested in
Wiener links. We'll put it up on the wall and see how it does, guys.
A penis with Assange's head on the end.
Well, actually, we have a character, the 3-foot penis monster, Harry Balls, who was discovered on the set of he's in Romeo and Juliet, and he has a big part in Poultrygeist, Night of the Chicken Dead. And he's been in almost all our movies.
He's a big part.
Terra Firma, he's got a kind of a walk on it. I don't know, hard on in Terra Firma, but he had bigger parts in pretty much every movie since then. And by the way, Volume 2 is Lemmy's last movie.
Yeah.
Very sad. Yeah, yeah. And Joe Fleischaker, our 500-pound action hero. Yeah. And we're going to dedicate Return to Newcombe High to the memory of Lemmy and Joe Fleischaker.
He was Prologus in Tromeo and Juliet.
Lemmy, yeah. Yeah, he sure was. And we gave him the most lines. He had the most lines.
Yeah.
And I didn't realize I should have given him subtitles. After that, we would. If you look at Return, you noticed in Return to Newcombe High, we gave him subtitles.
Which is hilarious.
But on Tromeo, he does all the narration.
Yeah. But it somehow works because it sounds legit Shakespeare.
Well, yeah. he definitely understood the part, but unfortunately he enjoyed his Jack Daniels and slurred a lot. So. Yeah. But he was a sweet guy. What a nice guy he was. He never said no to anything we asked for. Even Mr. Bricks, which I didn't direct. Mr. Bricks, a heavy metal murder musical, was directed by our editor, Travis Campbell. And I asked Lemmy for a song, and he gave it to Travis. I mean, it's a good film, but it's not, Lemmy was a good guy.
As I said in Airheads, Lemmy is God.
Actually, Motorhead's giving us a song for Return to Newcombe.
Oh, that's awesome.
Even after the death of Lemmy. Yeah. Aww. They're nice people, nice people. Yeah. Absolutely.
They're the track on the trailer for Tromeo.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Sacrifice.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, you. Good for you. Thank you.
No problem.
Thanks. For remembering all this.
Thanks, Rebecca. Big fan.
You guys really know what you're talking about.
Well, thanks for the years of
so much. Yeah.
Inspiration.
Yeah, on behalf of us and our listeners,
Well, it's inspiring to talk to people who really love movies and who know about movies, and because a lot of the mainstream do not. And it ends up, Lloyd Kaufman, tell us about yourself and that kind of stuff, and it's, where do I start?
Well, we left you waiting, so we have to make up for it with something.
No. Yeah, I was pissed off. I was really pissed off. I'm sorry, Rebecca.
It's okay. I feel bad.
I said to my wife when we were out in the cold street, look, we could be in Aleppo. I mean, you were nice about it. I was really pissed off because I'm a narcissist.
But by doing the show, you get a 3-picture deal, so, This is Blumhouse.
Wait, do we get this?
I'm pretty sure if I'm sitting here, I can green light anything.
Maybe
right?
We can work the penis monster into the next Purge film or something.
Well, we've written up a pitch for Class of Newcombe High TV show. And, it's a good idea. Save the Bell meets Deadpool. It's really
That's
good.
It's kind of adorable, guys.
It's a great TV show if anybody out there wants to make a series.
And also, I love that, to close this out, I know we're going a while, but I love that a lot of your soundtracks are coming out on vinyl now because the Class of Newcombe High, the original soundtrack is great. And I think Surf Nazis Must Die just came out as a
Indeed,
final
indeed. And they're doing again, this has nothing to do with us. It's other people. We can't do that's not our business. But they give us a little money and they buy the rights and they do limited editions and they sell immediately. Huge. Yep. They're working on Troma's War now. Aaron, who was assistant director on Return to Newcombe High, he and Justin Martell, who produced Newcombe High, Return to Newcombe High, they're doing Troma's War now. But the interesting Toxic Avenger, Justin Martell put all – he wrote this Tiny Tim book, which is out now, if you haven't read it, it's a definitive book about – and it's really well written. If you're interested in Tiny Tim, it's a terrific book. But the Toxic Avenger, they had all the songs signed up. Except one, which was Body Talk, which is the screen, the credit sequence. And that song was written by Corey Feldman's father. And the father told Justin, no problem, we'll let you license the song. They get publishing money. All this stuff, whoever owns the songs get residuals, so it's good for them. And when the movies play in certain parts of the world, they get fees from the governments. But when they went around licensing up all the movies, and then Corey Feldman's dad changed his mind. So without that song, you can't have a Toxic Avenger soundtrack. So it's a pity. Yeah, it's a pity. So if anyone sees Corey Feldman's dad, tell him to change his mind back and put it on, and then there'll be a vinyl of Corey Feldman. There's a guy who looks like Corey Feldman in Citizen Toxie named Kinky Finkelstein.
That is a great name.
And you'll see him in Citizen Toxie, the Toxic Avenger Part 4. He's very funny. He plays a doctor. He's terrific.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for coming down and giving us, us your time. As you said, it is very valuable, and we appreciate it.
Well, thank you for your time, and thank you, Rebecca and Ulrich and Rob, and the commissioner had to listen to this for 42 years.
And everybody, please check out Troma on YouTube, since you've got everything
Troma
there.
Movies on YouTube. It's all free, and if you're feeling like $4.99 a month, go to Troma now. Well, the first month is free, And check it out, Troma Now. It's world premiere movies. Hectic Knife, B.C. Butcher, Hunky Holocaust. Have you seen that, Rob?
I missed that one.
Oh, I've heard Banana Motherfucker.
Banana Motherfucker is calling
Banana
right
Motherfucker
now.
Is for free on Troma Movies. Yeah. That's not a world premiere movie, but it's hilarious. I met Fernando because there was a Troma retrospective in Spain, and they showed that movie. Mm-hmm. And my wife can verify it. I don't laugh a lot at movies, and I was just on the floor. It's so funny. Banana Motherfucker. It's hilarious. It's about the conquistadors, and it's very, very funny. You will love it. You will, I guarantee.
That's on my list for
anyone who's a Troma fan, you will love it.
Nice.
He sold me on Father's Day. Father's Day was when you sold me on that.
Yeah, isn't that a good one?
Yeah. I haven't seen it yet, but your selling point of
Father's
butt-fucking Father's is like, you know, I'm a father. Sold. Clearly we have something in common in this movie. So.
There's a lot more to it, but that's where the Father's Day comes, excuse the pun, but that's sort of...
Yeah, that's funny.
Anyway, thank you all so much
thank
for
listening.
Yeah, and here's to the future of Troma.
Yep, it looks
real
good.
Independence.
We're still going. We're still going, and independence lives. And hopefully the Tempest will spread the word. Maybe there's somebody out there who wants to lose some. I mean, who would like to be involved in a Troma movie.
And we'd like, I mean, just to end with our fans, we'd love to hear from you guys your first Troma experience. It's always a really fun thing to hear about how you discovered it and kind of the shock.
Tell us on Twitter, Facebook.
On Twitter, I do all my own Twitter. So if there are any Troma fans, I don't have anybody doing that for me. So,
all right, we'll tag you.
At Lloyd Kaufman. Nice.
We'll tag you and have people contact direct.
What's your Twitter?
Shockwaves Pod.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And then
will see it. We will
be tweeted a ton by us now.
I think I have seen it.
Thank you, Lloyd, so much. You're a legend, and we appreciate it.
Well, thank you, and thanks for answering me on Grindr, Rob.
That's how we got such a good guest.
That's where we end.
Oh, yeah.
Toxie for president.
Yay!